Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they are broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at popular education. Today, we are visiting with Dana Lyons at his home in lovely Bellingham, Washington. Dana has spent much of the past three decades or so recording albums, writing songs, and singing them all over the world, while also being very engaged with campaigns in the Pacific Northwest and other parts of the U.S. and other countries. From the efforts to stop the logging of the last of the West Coast's old-growth forests to more recent endeavors to put a stop to the miles-long coal trains currently making their way around the Northwest. Dana Lyons, welcome to Discussions with David.
Good morning, David.
I just realized I hadn't, I had my audio processing is all set wrong. Okay, now it's better. Hey.
Am I there?
Yeah, you're there. Am I there?
You're there. Good morning, David.
Can we start with this inevitably bizarre discussion given the circumstances, but what was the month of March 2020 like for you as the borders were closing and the pandemic was setting in? Did you have all sorts of travel plans that were castified? What was it like?
I did. And David, it's good to be here with you, an old friend and a fellow unemployed touring musician.
Exactly. Unemployed touring musician is just for me. I mean, I don't interview that many fellow unemployed touring musicians, so it's particularly interesting to talk to one. And also, yes. I mean, I have to say another part of my questioning line here is just that, like, your career has followed a very interesting trajectory, not only because you had actually like a fairly major global hit in the late 90s with Cows with Guns, but also because, like, since then, like, that happened at the very time that the age of the CD was just ending, like, but we were still in it. It was just ending. It was just before the invention of the MP3 that you had this huge hit. And then the music industry collapsed, like, immediately afterwards. You know, it's all the collapse began, you know, so it's a fascinating trajectory, I think.
Wow, you know, David, I have never
thought about it that way.
Because what's interesting, during the pandemic, I've been feeling so fortunate that I just toured my butt off all over the world, just like you, for so long, because now we're all under house arrest all over the world as we try to make our way through the pandemic. But so I was feeling thankful for that, even though at a loss for not being able, you know, feeling the loss of not being able to tour. But I hadn't looked at it that way. Yes, I kind of snuck in right under the wire with Cows with Guns, the end of CDs, which which means I actually made money, which I believe is against the law now for musicians.
Right, right. You're not allowed to do that anymore. Spotify has made sure that doesn't happen. But I wonder if the trajectory of the musical of the industry collapse for you was similar to mine. Like, was 2013 a big year for like everything falling apart? Like, was that around when Spotify started their free platform, or did you notice that year being a particularly bad
year? Yes, 2013 was the I think it was the turning year. I actually was looking at some of my journals, because what happened was, I mean, I had it good for a long time. I was touring. I mean, anyone, you know, why would anyone know this? I mean, most musicians can barely pay their rent, and that was in the good times. And you know, most when people think of musicians, they think of Michael Jackson or Madonna or Bruce Springsteen having a gazillion dollars. But for those of us who are working musicians who were scratching out a living, gigging all over the place, we could, you know, back in 2013, we could cover our bills. And then with the introduction of streaming, the CD sales went down and the streaming went, well, streaming of music went up, but you only get paid a fraction of the cost. So you basically made no money. But I remember in 2013, looking at my bank account, like my complex economic analysis consisted of looking at the total in my bank account. And if I was over a certain amount, I felt comfortable, felt safe. If it was below amount, I was like, oh my God, I got to work harder. And then I noticed, oh my God, it's going down, down, down precipitously. And then I had to change a few things, which happens as, you know, in our culture, as industries change. And well, as you know, the
because there's only so hard you can work, right? I mean, if you're touring X amount of months per year and you realize, oh, I have to work harder, but there's no more time to add more gigs to this schedule, right?
Exactly. As your listeners can imagine, while it's a blast touring all over the world, for me at least, it, after a while, it becomes exhausting and you have to take downtime. But to answer your first question, I had to cancel a 6-week Australia tour before the pandemic and a Philadelphia tour. So that was both painful spiritually and economically. But, you know, we're doing what we have to do. I remember reading one of your emails, David, and it said, my last gigs here have not been canceled yet.
Right? It was like everything's closing in on you, but you want to say, like, look, it's still happening as far as I know. You know,
I got a tour. By God, I'm going to do it.
The last gig I did on this tour, I was in Australia, and the tour got, you know, I canceled the last week of it, but I was only there for 2 weeks, supposedly, but it ended up being 1 week. But that final gig was just before St. Patrick's Day, when there and here and everywhere, it was like everything was shutting down. And it was probably an ill-advised gig, but it was definitely like it was a very hard, core, you know, it was like 10 fans. Like it should have been 50 or 60 people, but who ended up coming to that gig in Brisbane, very well organized gig, 10 people who were all like ready to get the virus in order not to miss my gig. You know, it was like the hardcore, you know,
I gave my life for David Rowe's show. Yeah. And so there's a 3rd of July, 3rd of July line, battle line. David Rogue show.
Yeah, you got to sacrifice your life for something. So you had a 6-week tour of Australia planned. That's major. That's every major city in Australia plus a whole bunch of others. Do you actually do a lot of tours in Australia where you're just playing small towns? I remember you saying.
I do better in small towns than I do in big cities. It's kind of fascinating. I have a song called "Cows with Guns." That was went to number 2 on the country charts in Australia. And the further in the outback you go, the fewer the number of radio stations there are. So put it this way, the Cows with Guns came out in 1996, and in the outback, they are still playing Cows with Guns. So,
and they still don't have internet access out there either. So they're listening to the radio. And yeah.
So the more in the middle of nowhere I go in Australia, the more famous I am. So it works very well.
That's I wonder if that happens to anybody else. I mean, that is so counterintuitive, you know, and it's totally the opposite of my experience with anywhere. You know, it's the bigger the city, the more I'll have like fans there because it's based on the internet. But like if your hit was on radio, it's a whole different phenomenon. It seems, and particularly like the more cows and the fewer people. I mean, generally fewer people and more cows, it kind of goes together, right? Once you get to the outback.
It is, it's pretty funny. The more ranchers per capita, the more people at my shows.
And then just to like put your hit into some context, which is I think even more fascinating, is that you were playing generally in the 80s, 90s, most of your audiences, I think it would be fair to say, it were people leaning in the direction of the environmental movement or people actually very much involved with some aspect of the environmental movement. And then you had Cows with Guns comes out and then you're getting invitations to play for bovine veterinarian conventions and rodeos. Right?
But that is correct.
how did that transition work out? I mean, what was that like? Like, did you play Turn of the Wrench? Like, you have a wonderful song, many wonderful songs about actually like things like sabotaging, you know, I mean, Turn of the Wrench is about sabotaging power lines that farmers don't want coming through their lands. It's like very militant, kind of direct action kind of song. And I went, how would a song like that go over at a veterinarian convention or a rodeo? Did you do it there?
Well, you know, I did. And I played, I remember playing Turn of the Wrench at, what is that? The biggest rodeo in Wyoming, Cheyenne Frontier Days. And it was fascinating. Turn of the Wrench, just to fill your listeners in a little bit, it's a song about, it's a true story about Minnesota farmers trying to stop power lines from coming over their land in the late 70s, early 80s. And they end up toppling the power lines. I based the song on a book. I did my research. The song was by a book called The Bolt Weevils by the late U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota. But I was singing it and kind of when I wrote it, I was thinking of, you know, I was thinking of it as an environmental song, kind of like, okay, we gotta, you know, gotta tell the story. And what is very interesting about that song is the more I played it at rodeos and, you know, bovine practitioner conferences, which means veterinarians and ag conferences. I've played a number of agricultural conventions. It's actually a farmer property rights song if you look at it very literally. And the farmers are getting ripped off and pushed around by the government all over the place, and they feel, in my opinion, reasonable resentment about it, and you know, are working to protect their property rights. So it was fascinating to me that Turn of the Wrench is actually goes over extremely well in ag country. But you know, to your point, I did have to change my set list a bit. You know, when I play in the outback of Australia, there's just a fascinating mix of people who come. You know, the local environmentalists, you know, some of them come, and you know, if you're playing a pub, everyone's there,
right?
And, you know,
Do they kind of self-segregate? I've noticed that some of my gigs, when they attract a really disparate crowd, like there's the environmentalists in one corner and then the rednecks in another corner, and they don't necessarily hang out together, or do they mingle? Did you notice?
Well, in Australia, you're so far out there that everyone's related anyway.
They're all mingling, so right?
Yeah. What's nice about a small town where everyone knows each other is people have a sense of humor generally about, you know, their differing politics, and they'll give each other grief and they'll joke around and, you know, a few pot shots. Hey man, you know, how's it going over in Greeny country, or the opposite. So one of the more colorful places I've played, I play at a biker bar in Humpty Doo, Northern Territory, which is about, isn't that the ultimate name?
Wonderful, wonderful.
Another town, Humpty Doo, Northern Territory, Australia. And that's, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know, maybe it's an hour away from Darwin, which is a town the size of Bellingham, also out in the middle of nowhere. It's the most isolated city.
That's an interesting putting in that context, a town the size of Bellingham, because you think of Darwin as being the only major city in the northern half of Australia, but it's actually a very small place.
The next closest town is 1,000 miles away from right. Darwin. So Darwin is isolated. But at the Humpty-Doo Tavern, there was a fascinating mix of, one, it's a biker bar, so there were bikers, and I would perform with my friend Jack Tenapple from Darwin and his band that we would all play together. But I remember in the middle of Turn of the Wrench once, six Harleys, which were packed, which is an outdoor show because it's in the tropics, and you know, you're slathered with DEET and nasty chemicals to keep the mosquitoes off you. And in the middle of Turn of the Wrench, six Harleys parked directly in back of the stage, which is an outdoor pavilion, which is maybe 8 feet away from me, all rev up in the middle of the song. And it was so awesome. And we just kept jamming, and I was just laughing, and the crowd was going wild. And they just take off and leave us in a cloud of dust. You couldn't breathe, had to wait to sing. But no, the you know, the farmers and the ranchers were there, the hippie greenies were there, you know, the local outback hiding from civilization were there, the bikers were there, and it was in good fun. I was able to actually even talk about some environmental stuff, and I didn't get booed off the stage. I kept it humorous.
Yeah, that's key. Huh? People can accept a lot more when it's coming in a humorous form. Or...
But I spin it. I spin it in a different way. You know, for each audience. So, but yeah, it's fun.
It's more about how you spin the intros than actually changing the set list. Is that, would you say that's about right?
Yes, there are certain red button songs, which I'm sure, which I know you have.
Right,
it's like I didn't play those tonight. You know, just leave those out. Don't push your luck. But in general, the fascinating thing about music and songs is people hear what they want to hear. So you can be singing something that you think is in direct contradictory to what your audience might be feeling, but they're going to hear it the way they hear it. And that's the beautiful thing about art. Art, the meaning of art is in the eye of the beholder. It's like, okay, yeah, as the songwriter, it's nice what I meant by it, but what it means is to the listener. And so as long as I don't get too preachy or hardline into the introduction or the outro, I can sing a song or spin the story in a certain way. And people are like, oh, that's cool.
One of the, I was just looking around on the net and listening to some of your songs that I haven't heard for a while. And I just was, Cane Toad Muster is just so good. And that video is so good. But, and I was, when I first went to Australia, it only took a matter of hours before I was introduced to the utter just hatred of cane toads. That is like, I mean, I was staying with somebody who was involved with bush restoration. So, I mean, you know, anybody involved with like native bush restoration hates cane toads perhaps more than the rest of society, but they're just universally despised. As you say in your song, it's like one of the things that, one of the few things that unites all of Australian society is a hatred for cane toads. How did you run across that when you first went there? Was it within a few hours of landing that you learned about the cane toads, or do you already knew about the cane toads before you went?
I've been to Australia many times, and my experience was just like yours. I learned about cane toads within hours of landing because they're such a menace. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with cane toads, they're an introduced species. They were introduced in Queensland amongst sugarcane to eat the sugarcane beetle. You know, one of those amazing, brilliant maneuvers that humanity likes to do. Well, if we have a problem with this, well, let's bring in one of those. What could possibly go wrong? And the cane toad, it's about the size of your fist. They're extremely toxic. If we touch them, it's like touching battery acid. It will burn your hand. So for us to pick them up, you have to be wearing gloves. Anything that eats a cane toad will die. So you can, you know, if you know anything about, you know, wildlife biology, you know, who eats frogs and toads? reptiles, mammals, birds, you know, in a continent where none of them are poisonous. So when you have everything eating it, what happens is it's almost like a neutron bomb for wildlife. As the cane toads move across Australia, all the large species are wiped out. It's really heavy. And I was actually there one year when they were passing through northern New South Wales. And I've never seen a large snake in New South Wales since then. But the reason I wrote the song, I was going up, I've always been told by my friends, oh, the Kimberley, which is the northwest corner of Australia, they said, that's the most remote, you gotta go, it's outrageously cool. So I was at a show in Darwin, and I thought, I'm gonna go out to the Kimberley. And I'm sure you're aware of this, David, but in any town or city, often the best educated people are the librarians and the journalists and radio DJs in particular are extremely well educated, especially at small stations, because they need to know everybody. They need to know all about the business and the train, and radio DJ needs to be liked by everybody to stay in business. So I called or emailed a radio DJ in Darwin, and I said, I'm interested in meeting Aboriginal leaders who are working on land rights and any environmental leaders. And she sent me quite a long list. And at the bottom, she said her favorite little group was called the Kimberley Toad Busters. And I was like, what does that mean? And so I called them, but they were a little volunteer group that goes around collecting cane toads at night and collecting cane toad eggs and trying to stop the spread of cane toads. But my friend, Lee Scott Virtue, who leads that group, she said, yeah, I'll set up for a tour for you. Would you write a song? And then I eventually wrote that song.
Oh, excellent. And you ended up with sticking to your philosophy of I'll do a gig once anywhere, which is a wonderful philosophy. You ended up playing at a Irish pub in Beijing. How'd that go? Did you do a tour in China?
I went on a trip with my friend, friend and musician Tim McHugh, and we were visiting a friend of his. This was back in 1999, before his first child arrived. So he had a buddy over there. I said, well, we better go to China before you become a dad. And so we went over for a couple of weeks, and it wasn't a tour, but Tim's friend arranged for us to play at an Irish pub in Beijing, which was fascinating. You know, Beijing, like all, you know, world-class cities, has quite a number of foreign residents in it. And there's a sizable expat community of Americans that live there, and English speakers and Europeans. And so when we played at the Irish pub in Beijing, the English was the predominantly spoken language. And you could even order Guinness. But my favorite thing about performing in China was it's the only place where my song Cows with Guns has been censored. Beijing, yes, and I can proudly put that on my resume. Censored in China.
Yeah, excellent. So was it going to be in the charts there, and then they made sure it wasn't, or how did it get censored?
No. Sadly, it was not a hit there. But in the English music newspaper, Beijing Beat, that's for, you know, English speaking expats, they did an article on Tim and I's show, and they printed all the lyrics of Cows with Guns, except Cow Say Tongue.
They couldn't make fun of Mao.
No.
So that was redacted? Was it just like blacked out or what?
It was just not there.
It was just like, this line doesn't rhyme. I wonder why.
It was fascinating. And I don't sing that line in China. And I have sung Cows with Guns in China since, but I want to respect their their customs and their, I believe it's the law. So, but I just found that fascinating.
Yeah, I wonder if you did sing it, you might get just quickly deported? I wonder, because there'd surely be somebody, a secret police agent in the audience. I don't know. A friend of mine tried to start an anarchist study group in China, and he got as far as the first meeting. and it was just him. Him and Chinese Secret Service, or, you know, government undercover cop, basically.
Tell and us that was the one group. Meeting.
Yeah. He was, a deportation order came like the next day.
How eager are you to go home?
Yeah.
No, when I've been lucky enough to go to China 3 times, and you know, they have strict rules about what you can and can't talk about. I'm a big free speech advocate, but when you go to someone else's country, if you want to stay,
yeah, you got to know the rules.
Right. So I follow the rules, and it's challenging. It's challenging in China because it's really not polite to talk about politics or religion. And it's easy for me to avoid religion, but then when people ask me, well, what do you do? What's your job? And I'm like,
yeah,
well,
I even say that. Yeah,
I'm a guitar player. Well, what do you sing about? And I came up with the line, I like to sing about nature.
Oh, that's good. That seems kind of neutral.
And people, you know, people over there, they're smart. They can read between the lines, and they can see when someone, a foreigner, is being respectful. And so we can take it from there. But it's
interesting.
It's a big deal.
And you get really much better at reading between the lines when you live in a society where you need to read between the lines more often. It's easier to communicate subtly when people are used to listening. There's a lot of countries where it's hard to actually talk about things openly, and because you know that nobody else is doing that. So if you do it, then you're just kind of like acting like an idiot, basically. It's kind of
right,
because you don't know who's listening, right? I mean, I've been, when I was in Jordan. We're just having a relatively innocent conversation about Arabic music, and then suddenly the conversation changed to the music that the king likes. And I was like, how did we suddenly transition to this subject? and then I realized, oh, it's somebody else. Somebody walked by. The guy who I'm talking to knew who that guy was. He walked by, and then suddenly he knew he was supposed to talk about the king. And so now we're talking about the king. All right.
Wow.
It was interesting. Yeah. But
I remember when I was younger, I did a tour of Russia and Siberia, and my father said before I went, he goes, just remember, there are big ears there. And since then, I've learned that there are big ears everywhere.
Everywhere. Just ask Edward Snowden. We are talking with Dana Lyons on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, Wednesday through Friday every week, along with other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. Of all these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovics, at Patreon, patreon.com/davidrovics, and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovick on any podcasting platform. Dana, learned that we have yet another thing in common that I didn't realize we had in common. On your website, it says you have performed in 48 out of 50 U.S. states.
That is still true.
that's also true of me. And I wonder, what are the two states you have not performed in?
I've never been to Arkansas or Oklahoma.
Oh, wow. I've never played in Mississippi or North Dakota. And somehow, as I was somehow expecting the two states you hadn't played in would be the same ones I hadn't played in, but no.
Clearly you have a bigger following than me in Oklahoma and Arkansas.
I mean, maybe if you wrote more songs about nuclear weapons, you would have ended up playing in Oklahoma City, because Stratcom is based there. So I have been there at least a couple times. No, it wasn't there. No, that's Nebraska. No, Omaha. Oklahoma City is a pretty active place around the anti-war movement. But I haven't, like so many places, I haven't been there in decades. But until the pandemic hit, were you still actually touring in the U.S. and like returning home with less broke than when you left? Is that something that you've been doing in recent years, or does it work somehow or other?
Yes. No, I've been, well, with the phasing out of CDs, that part of making a living as a musician is on a steady decline. It basically leaves me, the only source of income I had was touring. So even though that was declining because of declining CD sales, I was still able to make some money and, you know, break even and bring home some to pay the rent right after the pandemic. And you know, sadly, my Australia tour and my Philadelphia tour were looking very strong economically. I was set to make most of my annual living just from those tours.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, no, when the great day comes, when we can all be together safely and in one room and we can have performances and all sing along, no, I'll continue touring, and I expect to be able to scratch out a living from that.
Was it the same with you that there used to be a lot more gigs at colleges and universities, and now there aren't in the past? Or do you still play at colleges and universities in the US?
I get invited to the odd college now and then, but colleges used to be 50-70% of my income. I found that the older I get, the less college shows I get. And that's in part because it takes a lot of work to get a college show, as you know, and and I've been less willing to do that. But I think, you know, my sense is I'm playing less college shows because there are so many outstanding younger performers and activists coming up, and it's pretty cool in college to have someone close to your age rocking out. So like, you know, now when I play colleges, you know, I do my show, but I'll also hopefully do a number of classes. I'm more of in the professor role, which I also love. So usually I'm mostly, this year, my show in Philadelphia, I was invited to Swarthmore College by a senior, and sadly couldn't do that because of the pandemic. But I was going to do three classes with that. But most of my college shows now I'm invited by professors.
Mm.
Have you found it? Have college shows for you increased or stayed stable?
Completely dropped off completely. Maybe around 2000, I don't know, 6, 7. Mm-hmm. But all the young DIY performers that I ever talk to never get good college gigs, and always seem to be happy if they get a gig that pays like $100 or something. So it just seems like the whole sort of reality has just completely changed. And this, I think the census data that I heard about recently between the last two censuses, which of course has been like 10 years since the last one, so this is very old data, but the number of people claiming to be professional musicians, or basically claiming to be, you know, musicians in their catalog, like from a, you know, professional, you know, orientation, declined by 41% from one census to the next. So, I mean, it's just a reflection of the collapse of the industry, but it seems to me that it's very much part of the collapse is that the college gigs don't exist anymore. But what about playing in regular venues in towns? The other thing I've noticed is that they're shrinking, and the venues are physically shrinking in size, like the ones that you might get gigs in, and then becoming also more expensive to somehow use. Has that also been something you've noticed?
Yes. Even, you know, even before the pandemic, there were less and less venues. I worry that with the pandemic, many of the venues that still survive will go under. I just wrote to a friend of mine about one, and I haven't heard back from her yet. I'm a little worried about that venue. Yeah, most of my shows were evolving into being house concerts, or set up by a small environmental or social justice group where we, you know, we rent a Grange Hall or a room in a school. So it's kind of, the shows were sponsored by groups, but you know, the venues are getting tougher and tougher for sure. I play a lot of pubs and bars in Ireland and Australia. But in the United States, I tend to, I tend to not play that many bars because I just like, I like telling stories. I like to have an attentive audience. And that's one of the fascinating things I'm sure you see touring in Ireland. I was so shocked because when I toured Ireland, all my shows were in pubs. And in America, you're almost always background music in a bar, and people are talking, and you need to deal with that. It's part of the job. And in Ireland, from my observation, music and storytelling is, you know, almost a sacred thing. And the pubs have, even if you're playing in the big room in a pub, people will be quiet for music. And but if they have listening rooms, or I remember playing listening rooms where the place is packed, and, you know, the most sober person is finishing up their fourth pint of Guinness. And I walk on stage, and, you know, in America, I'd be background music. I'd be standing there, propping up my fragile ego, singing like everything was great. In there, I play two little notes and start singing. I could open the show in Ireland in a listening room with the most delicate, sensitive love song. And all these stinking drunk people hush each other. Wham! And it's silent. It's the coolest thing ever. I loved it over there.
Oh, that's great. That's also often the case, I've found, too. Not always, though, but I imagine that, I mean, it helps a lot if they actually are coming to hear you and they've paid to get in and that sort of thing, because you're probably not playing for pubs where it's like free entry, right? I imagine.
A mix. Well, back when I did those tours, Cows with Guns was a hit in Ireland. So some of the pubs were paid entry. So that definitely helped. But a lot of them were just the general public. And that was a little tougher, but people were still surprisingly respectful, or way more respectful than you'd find in a bar in the U.S. So, yeah, it was a real pleasure. Our friend Jim Page, I remember when I was heading over to Jim Page, great songwriter from Seattle. I was heading over to tour in Ireland, and I asked Jim, I said, "Hey, Jim, when you go touring in Ireland, you know, how much money do you make?" And he looked thoughtful. And he said, "Well, if I tour Ireland for a month and I come back with $200 in my pocket, it's been a really good tour." And then he says, you don't go to Ireland for the money." And I was like, "Ooh, I can't wait to go there." And it was absolutely true. You go there because it's sacred. Music and poetry and philosophy are sacred, and it's a spiritual experience. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Did you tour there before Cows with Guns and after, or
no, I know, David, you've had so much success touring all over Europe, and, you know, in the past you and I have even talked about doing a tour, and I regret not doing that.
I still want to. We'll have to wait a little while, but
we're still standing. We're still standing.
Yeah.
Goal number one, we got to survive the pandemic, and then we'll go.
Then we'll go.
But so I had traveled in Europe, but I had never toured there until Cows with Guns. It was so much fun. I had a back injury when Cows with Guns was a hit in Australia, so I wasn't able to tour when it was a hit. So when it broke in Ireland, I was like, I wasted no time. I heard it was a hit. I bought a ticket to Ireland. And I went with no gigs. And
oh, great.
I did an interview with Ryan Anderson, a BBC DJ up in Belfast. And he says to me, "So Dana, what, you've got a hit song, you're here in Ireland, do you have any gigs?" And I said, "Well, you know, I missed it in Australia. I didn't want to miss it here. So I just came." He goes, "Do you want some gigs?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, you heard it, folks." So he's broadcasting to all of Northern Ireland. "You heard it here, folks. Dana's got a hit song, Cows with Guns. He needs gigs. Call this number." And he reads the number several times. Great. "We need Dana to get Dana some gigs." By the end of the show, I had 10 gigs.
Oh, fantastic.
So incredible.
Was that your like cell phone number he was reading on the air? Or
no, it was some, the station number.
People, the station number. They were calling the station. Oh, fantastic. That's a That's a really novel way to do it. That's fantastic. And then there's no time to really promote the gigs, but no need, because you got a hit and they can just get the word out pretty quickly.
The top DJ in Northern Ireland is pushing it. And Ryan Anderson was an amazing, is an amazing human being. He was the top DJ in Northern Ireland, top morning DJ. And as you all know, morning DJs have to do comedy and, you know, you're working the crowd. Everyone's waking up, driving to work. He was the top morning DJ in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. The Protestant Irish and Catholic Irish. And what was outrageous about Ryan Anderson was both sides loved him during a war. And to me, that's a remarkable statement.
Yeah, really impressive. We're breaking up a little, Dana.
See at festivals.
We lost you there for a few seconds. Back. Yep. But that's
yeah, he was just a peacemaker and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he would go to festivals on both sides and he was loved by all, and he would talk on the radio, and he would talk against violence and talk for human decency and the rights of everyone. He a remarkable human being. It was an honor to meet him.
Yeah, nice. And do you have any hopes for plans when the pandemic is over? Are you thinking about the future, or is it just, I mean, I find people in Europe are talking about future plans, and I don't hear anybody talking about future plans realistically in this country. but every time I hear people in Europe talking about future plans, I'm thinking like, oh, wow, it must be so different there. Yeah.
Well, this is America. We don't have any future plans here. No, I've actually studied pandemics much of my adult life. I'm kind of a pandemic nerd, and
really?
So I've been watching. Yeah. One of my best friends here in town is a pandemic expert. He's actually the public health officer for a neighboring county. So mm-hmm. He and I every winter we're analyzing all the different bugs being created, and you know, many of them are created in Southeast Asia, and that's because people are in such close proximity with each other and with birds. Most of these diseases come from birds.
Mm. And a lot of it has to do with encroaching on natural habitat, right? Is a lot of the
yes.
Interconnection between humans and animals like that?
It's both encroachment on natural on habitat, which this one appears to be, and also it's being in very close proximity with farm animals, like the beautiful markets. They're so amazing in China, where you go down and there are, you know, people, there's wall-to-wall stalls with live animals, and it's an animal rights nightmare, but it is incredibly fascinating. But when you have, and then the people live in those stalls, so it's kind of a breeding ground, and it just doesn't, it's not just Southeast Asia. You know, it's a, you know, it happens, you know, these bugs happen all over the world. But in terms of my plans, I want to, you know, stay healthy, get strong, do what we're doing. I'm in it for the long haul. I see no evidence to be hopeful that we're going to be touring anytime soon.
No.
The first thing, you know, obviously we have to do is learn how to live with it so it doesn't spread, so we respect the people who are vulnerable to the disease and respect our medical professionals and first responders.
And what about containment? I mean, with all your conversations with your friend about pandemics, like the idea of containing it, I mean, it's been contained, right, in some countries, and sure isn't here.
Huh? Oh, New Zealand has zero cases.
Right. China had
shut down
yesterday.
Yeah. So the goal for every country should be to go to zero cases. Because guess what? When there are zero cases, then you can resume doing many normal things. And zero cases is possible. But to achieve that, you have to do a mega shutdown.
And you have to have a public health sector that's actually doing contact tracing, right?
Mega contact tracing. And this is like, we have trouble in the United States for many reasons. One, we've got a downright idiot president, excuse my French, not to down the French, but you know, I just can't say anything else about him. He's a irresponsible fool when it comes to this. And he's making it just worse. Two, like in China, I was very impressed. The culture there is more community oriented. And so people, even before this, so they wouldn't give sickness to other people. You know, American culture is more individualistic. We're like, hey, this is my freedom. I don't have to wear a mask. I can shop and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's a cultural problem when it comes to dealing with this pandemic. And so if Americans really want to get the economy going, they're going to have to learn to protect everyone else around them and wear masks, which is a very un-American cultural thing. So it's going to be interesting to watch our culture evolve or not evolve. From all the numbers I'm seeing, I'm just keeping my head down, doing fun interviews like this with you. Hopefully we will get a new president who does something good for the pandemic, gets it under control. And then when we're down to zero cases, then we can start reopening and, you know, living life to its fullest again. But even then it's going to be cautious. I have some lung stuff, so I'm in a high risk group. So
right.
You know, I'm not going to be performing for, you know, until it's really safe. I'm not going to be getting on planes or anything like that. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be a while. If we're lucky, some smart scientists will create a safe and effective vaccine, but that's not a given. So
right.
We do our best.
And then there's also all kinds of likelihood of other pandemics coming along in the near future, right? I mean, there was in the mainstream news, they love to talk about this as a once in a lifetime event and unprecedented, but it's neither unprecedented. I mean, it may be once in a lifetime for the past in the terms of the past 100 years, but that doesn't mean it's going to be another 100 years before the next pandemic.
Right. There's this thing called biology. You may have heard of it.
Yeah. I realize you know something about it. So I'm not just randomly asking the question.
That's why you brought a songwriter on today to talk about biology. Let me tell you.
I was going to talk about music, but then you mentioned you knew this public health expert in Bellingham that you talk to all the time. So now I have to talk about biology.
My cover is blown. Rather than being the happy-go-lucky rock and roller. Yes, folks, I am a nerd, but I can tell you, I'm gonna break your bubble too. Rovich is also a nerd.
I'm not a biology nerd, although we're all like amateur epidemiologists these days, right? I mean, I have not read so much about about viruses in all my life.
I study this a lot. I read about what's going on in other countries. I think most of the world's pretty well educated about this, except for the United States. So, but for our fellow Americans here, we're getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July. If you're interested in the pandemic, study what's going on in Asian countries in particular. Europe is also very interesting, but Singapore, South Korea, China, and Vietnam are all very interesting case studies. And then New Zealand and Australia, for cultures that are more similar to ours, are also very interesting. But that's how you can read
in terms of containing the virus. Although Singapore is also an interesting example because of their weak links in the chain there with all those immigrant workers who are treated like living in near slave conditions.
And that is one of the fascinating things about this pandemic is if you're going to contain the pandemic, you have to treat your poorest workers with the most dangerous jobs well.
Right, it's really exposing that whole underbelly.
There's no way around it. You can, we're pulling, Trump is pulling the classist stuff, trying to force the meat workers back to work. And the bottom line is if you force people back to work in unsafe conditions, the virus is going to explode and it's going to affect the wealthy as much as the poor. Maybe not as much as the poor, but the only way to get the economy on track is to make sure all workers are treated in a safe fashion. Isn't that fascinating?
Isn't it a fascinating moment for people who have been advocating for equality for a long time that now actually the rich have to pay attention to the poor because they're all part of the same society and they're all breathing the same air and everything else, huh? But then in terms of response, I'm here in Portland, listening to the politicians talking about how well Oregon is doing in responding to the pandemic. Meanwhile, the numbers are growing every day, the numbers of new cases, and the streets of Portland and other major cities in Oregon are lined with tents, with people living in tents, and the hotel rooms are all empty. What's the situation? I know you're probably not getting out of the house much, but you know lots of folks in Bellingham. What's going on in Bellingham? Are the streets lined with homeless people living in tents, or is anything being done about that?
There are street people living in tents on the streets here, certainly a lot in Seattle and Olympia. it comes back. There was an article, I think, on CNN yesterday with Andrew Yang supporting the bill that would give every American adult $2,000 a month for a period of time to, one, make sure more people don't get kicked out of their homes, and two, bolster the economy. And this pandemic, it's affecting us in every way. Both you and I, David, have greatly reduced our carbon footprint.
That's for sure.
Which is pretty funny. I used to joke, I drive and fly all over the world using up hundreds of gallons of gasoline, trying to convince other people not to fly and drive all over the world using hundreds of gallons of gasoline. And, I think, there's a role for the storytellers. And, I think we get a certain amount of leeway with that. However, the pandemic has greatly reduced climate emissions. It's forcing the examination of our entire economy, because like you said, the people on the streets, they need homes. They need homes now, or we're all going to get more of the virus. So that's one. Two, you need to help the people, the whatever 40% of the people who have lost or had reduced jobs, they need money, or they're going to be on the streets spreading it. Then there's, of course, political unrest. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, people were against his quote socialism, but really he rescued capitalism from imploding. And if the banks and the corporations and the powers that be want to keep the U.S. economy going, they're going to have to print a lot of money and fork it over to unemployed touring musicians like you and me.
Right.
And the other, I believe that the figure is between 35% and 40% of the people are gig workers in this country, sole proprietors. And I'm very thankful that they created unemployment now for self-employed people.
Did you apply for it?
Oh yeah, and I'm getting
it. You get it? I have been applying for it since last April I've never yet once gotten anything but a business signal. And I've already been rejected. And then they say you get rejected and then you apply again and then you'll get accepted, but that involves actually talking to somebody on the phone. And it's impossible here.
It is impossible. I got extremely lucky and got through on a phone. I was applying for months and managed to get through.
Oh, excellent.
But they, that needs to go in effect, or we're going to have way more homeless people and the economy is going to crash and the pandemic is going to go. So it's fascinating how this pandemic is forcing us to look at all these different social justice issues and economic issues and political voting issues. And eventually it's going to be forcing us to look at environmental issues. That really hasn't come up too much yet, but.
But as long as they keep talking about this as a once in a lifetime event, at some point they're going to have to start talking about it. You're hearing some very impressive stuff coming out on, stuff that you would never expect to hear anybody say on like national public radio, like talking about how, most people in this society are living paycheck, were living paycheck to paycheck before the pandemic, and then the pandemic hit and the paycheck stopped. I heard that. That's a quote from Marketplace yesterday. And you just don't hear them talking about widespread poverty and hardship in the U.S. too much. They're much more interested in talking about the stock market usually, but that's changing. But they're still referring to this as a once-in-a-lifetime event, the way they talk about floods as like 100-year floods, even though they're happening every year, you know. I mean, how many times have I visited Hebden Bridge in England and it's like once again destroyed by flooding? And once again, you listen to BBC and they're talking about it like this is another 100-year flood just destroyed the town of Hebden Bridge again. And the last time was 3 years ago. Well, you know.
No, I think that's a really good point. And there is this, you know, repetitive, this is a once in a lifetime thing. Wow, we're going to have to weather this. And I get that it is a once in a lifetime thing for us now, but a year from now, the pandemic or whatever's going on then might like make this one look like a breeze. And, you know, I hope it's a once in a lifetime thing, but if you look at what nature's doing with climate change, it is not surprising that this is occurring. And Mother Nature, there's a wonderful bumper sticker. I love this bumper sticker. It says, "Nature bats last." And friends, nature is at bat. And I hope that I'm wrong about this, but I have a feeling that we're entering the time, you know, the rest of the species have been dealing with the apocalypse caused by us for a long time. They've been under duress and going extinct for a long time. It's finally starting to hit home for our industrial culture. And I fear that things are gonna get tougher and tougher. And so it's interesting, as we're entering our fourth month of this, it's kind of sinking in for me. Oh, wow, this is kind of real. And going back to your question, do you hope to be touring? I do hope to tour someday. I think the rules are gonna be quite different. But what I'm thinking of is this could go on for a while. And like you said, there could be more floods and fires and everything else. And I believe we need to hunker down and really think through how to take care of our communities. Everyone.
Is there much of that going on around Bellingham that you hear about, mutual aid?
On the neighborhood level, there's tons of it. I'm very proud of a lot of people I know working very closely on neighborhood stuff, local farms, everybody's gardening. So that's very hopeful. You know, people aren't going to wring their hands and go, "Oh gosh, the pandemic," and go off and starve. They're going to do what they can. But we need to, as a society, you know, currently we are still the United States, if you're watching in this country. Each of our countries needs to, if you're watching from a country that has some semblance of democracy, and I would say the United States, compromised as it is, still has some semblance. And what I define by some semblance is if enough people get organized and get together and have an agenda, they can push some change through the legislature. And while it's not easy, if it's possible, you still have some semblance of a democracy. Well, on the, you know, local, state, and federal level, you know, this is the type of activism I'm interested in. I believe that we have an opportunity here to elect outstanding people. And I know it's easy to be cynical, and because there's so many corrupt people in office, I get that. But there's also a lot of wonderful people in this world. There are, you know, there are wonderful nurses and doctors. There are wonderful teachers. There are wonderful clergy. If you think about your town, think about the amazing amount of good people just trying to help people out. People working at nonprofits, trying to help homeless people, people trying to protect the environment, to clean our water, to take care of our kids. There's loads of great people in our society. Imagine if some of them were our governors and our senators and our congresspeople and our mayors.
Instead of real estate developers and arms brokers. Yes.
And so if we elect as many people as possible who care about the community, then we may see societal change. And then we might see serious efforts to address systemic racism and serious discussions about reparations, you know, to both the descendants of African American slaves and to Native Americans. All these things need to be addressed, and they're coming to a head in the midst of this pandemic. And so we're all in the hot seat right now. It's go time. Mm-hmm. And we can go up or we can go down, but either way, it's go time.
We're going.
So we're going.
Yeah. And Dana, are you, do you have any regular broadcasts going on? I know you've been playing with StreamYard lately. Are you doing any regular broadcasts on the internet, Facebook somewhere?
Not yet, but you are my mentor, and I love your your radio spiel. And you can hear me this. I'm like, oh wow, I have to learn that.
Hoping you write that stuff down, then you can read it, right? You don't. I couldn't remember to say that stuff anyway. Otherwise,
I'm gonna be. You're gonna be my. You're gonna be one of my mentors on this day. So, I'm hoping. I'm doing kind of irregular ones as I learn. I'm hoping to kick in earnest when the rains return here in Bellingham in September and October. I'm gonna try to take as much advantage of the summer to get strong.
Right.
I'm finishing up an album. I'm hoping to do this. And
excellent.
When the rains began, I'm hoping to release my new album. I'm hoping to announce my new Patreon fundraising site. Okay. And I'm hoping to start a mostly weekly show like we've talked about. And I will be phoning you up and we can chat on StreamYard about this.
Excellent. Looking forward to all that. Dana, thanks so much for joining me for the hour. It's been a great pleasure. Haven't laughed this much in a while somehow.
Thank you, David. No, it's a joy to hang out, and let's do it again soon.
Definitely. Thank you. Take care. And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Dana Lyons. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form on various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. My latest album, Notes from a Failed State, is now on Spotify and all the other usual music streaming platforms. To celebrate, I'll be having a little one-man album release party tomorrow on July 4th, broadcast on whatever platform you're watching on from here in my living room at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my community-supported art program, or CSA, at davidrovix.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovix. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.